Two Pints in the Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue. Welcome, Two Pints in the Corner with Tony Rain and Dinky Dawson. Tony's still recuperated down on the Cape, so I've got my friend Sean McNally to be able to do this with me. And boy, does he find some wonderful people. These guys
were found us too.
Yeah, that's what I mean. These guys coming up were the Straw Dogs, are the Straw Dogs, and formerly the FUs. And
we're still the FUs.
Oh, you're still there. I like that.
It's full circle.
It goes around. I love it. Oh, my God. All right, you guys. This is John, Bob.
Yeah.
No, Job, Steve, and Ian on phone with Sean McNally. And I'm with Sean doing this. We welcome him again to Two Pints in a Corner. And please, Sean, take over from here because you guys know each other so well. After, you know, hardcore, I've only got one statement to say later on to you about hardcore, sure. about hardcore and where it came from, and you're not going to believe it. You're going to freak.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dinky. I appreciate it. Little gremlins in the phone there. And unfortunately, we're going to have Bob Hatfield as well joining us, a drummer, but he had a last-minute thing pop up. So we'll have to do today with John and Ian and Steve, which is we'll have plenty to talk about, I'm sure of that. So welcome, guys. Thanks for taking the time. I know it's not easy to get us all together at the same time here, but as we've talked about, you know, the channel was a pretty important place to all of us one way or another, and we are going to talk about that a little bit later on. But in the meantime, I just want to kind of give a background, a little bit of backstory from each of you, you know, how you guys came up, where you grew up, where you got into music for the first time, and then how you ended up in Boston. So why don't we actually start up with John, and then we'll have Steve join, and then Ian, you go last since you're the newest guy and the baby guy in the band so far, okay?
Sounds good.
Okay. So I was raised in suburban Connecticut, and I was a typical suburban rocker kid, you know. But I was always a misfit. My neighborhood were kind of like the misfits too. The kids in the neighborhood, they weren't. Sunday wasn't the day that you got sat around the TV and watched the game. Sunday was the day we got together and listened to each other's new records.
Great stuff.
And I got exposed to a lot of different genres back then. At first, it was like, you know, prog rock, like Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and Yes, and then it, but it was also Deep Purple and Black Sabbath and Blue Oyster Cult and bands like that. So, and then when punk came out, you know, I had a friend who had a subscription to, I believe it was, what's that magazine that has Boy Howdy as a logo?
Green.
Dream, yeah. He was a subscriber to that, and you know, he was reading about punk rock and reading about No Future, and like, you know, we didn't have the same problems as the kids did in London. You know, we didn't have rabid unemployment, but you know, but there was a lack of things for kids to do unless you were like considered normal. You know, like a preppy, you were normal if you were a preppy. You know, that back then. So we weren't normal. So we just continued listening to music, and then we started listening to the Ramones and the Sex Pistols, and everything else started sounding really slow and powerless, you know. So that became, you know, the staple for me. And living in right next to New Haven, which was a stepping stone for like bands coming from Boston towards New York and vice versa, and people coming from overseas to Boston and stopping in New Haven and going to New York. You know, I got to see the Dead Boys early on and the Ramones early on, and I missed the Stranglers, but they played it in New Haven too at a place called Toad's Place, but it was on a Monday night and I hadn't heard about it. But There's a lot of cool bands came through there. But I guess this is a precursor to the kind of issues the bands are having. Going into another country, and playing, because you've heard of the band Penetration. They're a punk band from England with a female lead. They were supposed to play this little bar in Connecticut and called the Oxford Ale House. And it was on a Wednesday night, and, my friends and I were all excited to go. We got there. There was a sign on the door saying, the show's canceled because they had trouble getting into the country. And I can't imagine that's any better now.
Yes, that'd be true.
Thinking about what happened to the UK subs and all that.
Right.
But hopefully,
hey, John, I want to get back at some point. You have a great story with the Dead Boys, which is amazing to see. That's as far as the band to see and kind of be live. What an amazing introduction, right? So I want to get back to that show later on. But
okay.
You did come to Boston, right? You came to Boston for school, and that's kind of how you got became a Bostonian, so to speak, in the area.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. And where did you go?
I went to BC, Boston College.
Okay. And there was very easy for all the punks to stand out, I'm sure.
Yeah, because it was almost like suburban Connecticut placed inside of Boston, because it was all preppies and future yuppies, So if you showed any sign of being into anything different from that, you were like a magnet to the other people who were, so all five of us got together very quickly, and even though it was a school with a high population, but that was kind of the good thing about punk back then. If you were riding on a public bus and you sat down next to a kid who had a black flag pin on their jacket or whatever, you could strike up a conversation, and you couldn't do that with anybody else, especially in New England, because New Englanders, they don't open up to strangers very quickly. But, you just had an instant rapport with this person. And that was the great part of it. The other part of it was Boston not liking people who are different, even though they advertise as being somebody as being really open and liberal and all that stuff. You had a lot of jocks and a lot of just basically dickheads that wanted to beat people up that were any different.
Right. Excellent. Good stuff. And I want to get back. I know how ZBC was a big part of that with you, and I want to get back to that in a little bit. But before we do that, let's go to Steve. Now, Steve, as a lead guitar player, you grew up also kind of in southern New England. Why don't you go about where you came up from and where you ended up going?
Well, I started off growing up in northern New Jersey, like Sopranos country, and then moved to Connecticut, and my family was kind of musical. My mother was very musical, was always playing piano and sung in the church choir and all that stuff, and my sisters played piano, and I was playing. Yeah, I was taking some guitar lessons and playing trombone in junior high band. So it was music was an accepted thing in the family.
Mm-hmm.
But after high school, I went out to the West Coast, to Washington State, and I started picking up. I was into punk by that time already. I saw the Ramones playing at this little club in Westport, Connecticut, just about the time the first album came out, and I was like, okay, this is different. I like this. And then I went out to the West Coast.
I think I was there too.
The West?
I think I was at that show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I didn't know you, but
it's awesome.
But anyway, I went out to the West Coast, and living near the Canadian border, and so I'd go up to Canada to see DOA, Pointed Six, the Canadian Subhumans. I'd see shows in Seattle. There's a great place called the Showbox. I saw the Jam there, and Magazine, which was a great show,
wow,
and Iggy, and I saw the Clash on the Give 'Em Our Throat tour, and you know, so I was picking up on all the West Coast stuff and getting records from L.A. and San Francisco and stuff, and the Vancouver and Seattle stuff, and I moved back to the East Coast, and I wanted to move to Boston. I wasn't going to school yet or anything, but I came back and I got guitar and stuff and started playing and started writing songs and going to shows and picking up, like John was saying, running into people who were into punk and you know, starting to check out new bands. And you know, I met like Springer and Al Baril back then and stuff like that, and you know, I was busy writing songs and stuff.
Right. It was a pretty small community still at that point, like you were talking about. Right. We'll get back to you as well, Stephen, a bit. Now, Ian, I want to have you jump on board here. You are the newest member of the band, essentially. You joined them about a dozen years ago or so. But tell us about your background, first of all, and where you came from and what you've been doing.
Well, I was born in Boston in the late 50s to a single mother. Well, my dad split for New York in the late 60s. And she was a piano player. She had already, as a kid, played for the as a pianist for the Boston Ballet, and she was a bit of a prodigy. She got she started studying with Madame Shaloff and became a Berklee student around 69-70. And so I grew up around Edgeley Road, right behind Berklee College of Music, in the early 70s, as I was a very small kid. My mom graduated from Berklee in 73. Started teaching at Berklee while going to New England Conservatory. And so I was surrounded by basically jazz and classical music. Spent a lot of time at the conservatory, a lot of time at Symphony Hall, a lot of time at Jordan Hall at Harvard and places like that. But also my mom's boyfriend was a jazz pianist. And so I spent a lot of time as a really little kid, Pooh's Pub in Kenmore Square, Paul's Mall, Jazz Workshop, because you know, these were gigging musicians, and so I'd be oftentimes instead of getting a babysitter, they'd keep me at the bar and get me a Shirley Temple and do a couple of sets. So I grew up as a very small kid, surrounded by jazz music pretty much entirely, which was the thing at the time. I remember I had an aunt, and I used to meet her at North Station. And they would have a head shop, like a rock shop, at North Station. And there'd be big posters on the wall of, you know, Led Zeppelin and Jimi Hendrix and such. And I wanted to see something like that because I'd seen a lot of classical and a lot of jazz. And so my aunt said, well, I don't know if I can take you to that, but let me see what I can take you to. And she took me to my first rock concert, if you will, which was Tower of Power, Sly and the Family Stone. Nice. The Hughes Corporation Bobby Bird, trumpet player, at White Stadium in Jamaica Plain in '74. So I was surrounded by jazz, and consequently, in '75, when I was in grade school in second grade, I took up the trumpet, and I started getting lessons with a famous pre-war jazz player named Wes Hensel at Berklee College of Music. And I basically, that was my main interest until somewhere around 77, 78. My mom thought I was a little anachronistic because I watched nothing but old movies and listened to jazz music. And so she got me a turntable, got me some Chuck Berry, some records by the Beatles, the Stones, Buddy Holly, this kind of thing. And I started listening to rock music, and I approached it, you know, very similarly. You know, I didn't like a lot of what was happening contemporaneously in the 70s in rock music. I didn't like the excessive stuff, probably because I was so young, but I really liked the 50s stuff. And so I really resonated with, you know, like the King Biscuit Flower Hour, which was on the radio that I would listen to every week, and that kind of thing. Bobby Day, you know, Rockin' Robin, these kind of songs. And that's right around the time that punk started happening, and at summer camp, the B-52s song, Rock Lobster, started getting some airplay. Squeeze started getting some airplay. Elvis Costello started getting some airplay. And this stuff sounded not that far from the 50s era rock and roll that I, an early 60s era rock and roll that I enjoyed. So I started taking up an interest in rock music, primarily punk rock, which was a new form of music, or what was being soon there called new wave. And I started buying Krauser Press, and I started, you know, I was a real book guy. I read a lot. And so I would go to the magazine stores and look for any magazines that covered that kind of stuff, because in school, talking about, you know, obscure bands that people didn't know about, you know, gave me an edge. I did not have an edge in sports. So my edge really was being a music nerd, somebody who knew a lot about music stuff. And so punk was an area for me that was an entrance to meeting new friends. And I did that for a couple of years in school, bought records, talked about punk, read about punk. And at some point, at the church in Harvard Square, a band called the Misfits were playing. I had heard the FUs at that point, and so I was excited to go see a hardcore show. And his dad drove, and so I went to that show. And after that show, for the next year, I would pester my mom to give me approval to go to any all-ages show I could go to. And she didn't give me that much approval, but finally in 84, my grades started slumping and I wasn't doing so hot in high school. And I just started going to pretty much every show, from 80, late, mid 80, late 83, around the time of the Husker Du Minutemen show or the SSD Circle Jerk show at the channel, pretty much all the way through the 80s. I pretty much flubbed out of school and just spent my time hanging out with punk rockers and Ken Moore at Harvard. And, I was not a musician at that point because I played trumpet. I did not play guitar or bass or drums. And I kind of figured that, you know, how was I going to play catch up? Because I was considerably younger than most of the people who were in bands. And so I just decided, hey, I'm going to get really good at stage diving. And that's pretty much what I did for about 10 years. But by the late 80s, I realized that I wasn't going to get a lot of mileage with that any longer. So I figured I better learn how to play an instrument and maybe I could get into a band. So at that point, I took guitar lessons, a lot of guitar over at Cambridge Music. And there was a white acoustic guitar that I still have. And my mom at Berkeley signed me up for Guitar Week at Berkeley. And that's when I got the black SG that I'm still playing. I started a band, The Grenades, in somewhere around 93, 94 with various lineups until we got one together. And we started playing shows in the Boston area pretty heavily between 94 and probably 2002 or so. And we played first Dropkick shows with the Outlets and the Freeze. We played the Rat a whole bunch of times. And punk music, just, you know, straight up British style punk music was really taking a big return at that point in time here in Boston with bands like The Unseen and other bands of that type. And so that's pretty much what I did until I got married, had a kid, and found myself divorced with a lot of time. And, you know, at that point I was an okay guitar player, rhythm player anyway, and started subbing for some bands who needed a guitar player. And eventually I got an audition for the FUs that John called and asked me to come do. And I went and did the audition, played somewhere about, I don't know, 15, 20 songs, was told, you know, that it sounded okay, but that they had another interview happening shortly thereafter. And as I was walking out of the practice space, Joe Koons was walking in, and I thought to myself, wow, if they've got Joe Koons from the Freeze, you know, I don't have that gig at all. What a waste of time was learning those songs. But John called me up a week later and said, hey, we liked actually both of you. Could you come for a second audition? Came for a second audition, and John and the guys, I guess, chose to go with two guitar players. So I joined the FUs somewhere around 2015 with Joe Koons on lead and I on rhythm. And, you know, I've been in the band ever since.
Awesome. Awesome. Good stuff, Ian. Thank you for that. So you may see them for a few decades, or I don't go back to now. I want to step back to, so John, you're at BC. WZBC is a pretty influential part of your upbringing at this point as well, and some of the friends you've made on campus. Kind of take us from your BC time to moving into Alston, and then
starting to put a band together. I think it was you and Fur Apples at first, and then kind of take us from there if you could, and how Steve got into the picture.
Okay, but first let me interject about when Joe Coons and Ian were our guitarists. Steve was living in Texas at the time and flying up when he could to do shows. So, when Steve flew up, who did we play with from Pacific Northwest? Joe took a back seat and Steve played lead and Ian played rhythm. So, you know, and then it got to the point where Joe was being asked to rejoin the Freeze. And so he moved out to Arizona, and Steve moved to Salem. So that kind of solved that issue right there. So all the original members were back in the band. So where were we? Okay, you asked me about going to BC and meeting people, especially people involved with radio, WZBC people,
Yeah, and then how the FUs became a thing. You and Bob getting together and where you guys first rehearsed and
This girl I was dating at the time saw an ad in the Phoenix, which she showed me because, you know, I seemed like I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And she said, you like to sing, and you've always wanted to be a singer. Why don't you give this guy a call? And then there was an ad that Bob for Apples had put, in the Phoenix. And so he listed a bunch of, he said, I'm a drummer. I want to start a band. He listed all these bands. He just like checked every box for me, you know, the Sex Pistols, Ramones, the Jam, you know, the Clash, everything. And so I called him up and I said, yeah, well, I love all those bands, you know, I'd like to start a band with you. And so I was playing a little bit of guitar and, you know, just enough to play like basic chords and for like Sex Pistols and Ramone songs, but, you know, nothing like fast hardcore. So, we started jamming in the basement of the apartment where I was living on Com Ave. We did some, we put out an ad for a guitarist because, you know, the two of us weren't going to be a band. And we interviewed a bunch of people. They just didn't make it. You know, it was either the ability or the image or the both just didn't fit. So, and at the end of the auditions that we did in the basement, along comes this guy, I mean, he must have been 7 feet tall, and he was wearing black clogs, which made him even taller. And he had this long, blonde, dyed hair, like, down to his ass. And he dressed in these kind of flashy rock clothes, you know, and Bob and I are looking at him, trying to find the place through the basement window, and he's, like, spinning back and forth to try to figure out which direction to go in. And he was actually, like, right in front of the house, but he didn't know it. So and Bob's like, oh, shit, he found the door. And he comes in, you know, we gave him an audition. I mean, he came all that way. He has to be out. He showed up on time, right? But I could tell that, like, I'm pretty sure that he was the guitarist from that band Darling. I don't know if you remember them from the early Rat days, but they were this original but very Styx-influenced kind of band. And everybody in the band looked like the guy I just described. So I'm pretty sure he was the guitarist in that band. So yeah, I think he knew like a couple of Clash songs. So we jammed together on that, and he was good. But then when he got to the solo part, he came up to me and like, you know, made that intense arena rock face, you know, and like rocking with me and facing me, and I was trying not to laugh. It was really hard, and I didn't want to laugh because, you know, I knew the guy was trying his best, and he was good at what he did. It just didn't fit. So and that was like one of the best of the interviews. But the guy we eventually settled on before Steve was this guy who was excellent guitar player. I mean, he could play, you know, everything by the punk rock bands at the time. He could also play slide guitar, you know, he could play George Thorogood covers. He could play anything. He was a really talented guitarist. But he looked like a disco boy, you know. he had the tight pants and the blow-dried hair parted in the middle and gold chains and everything else. And I was just, you know, and so one of my friends said to me, you really want this guy in your band? I mean, he doesn't seem like he's dead. So I'm like, he's so good, though. But, you know, he was also, his day job was an airplane cook, you know, for a major airline. So his schedule changed all the time. So you know, we figured we'd have to get somebody more permanent. So I put out another ad. Steve answered. You know, he looked the part right away. You know, he had cropped hair and a striped shirt and spiked wristbands and, you know, the whole Megilla. And
it must have been the spiked wristbands that did it. That's good.
they helped. And you know, he's kind of quiet, you know, kind of a little reserved, but then he says, I've written some songs, and he pulls this like wad of paper out of his pocket. And it's all these original songs that he's written. So, and he showed us some of the lyrics and, you know, it was pretty funny. It was like, you know, had the same kind of sense of humor that we had, but in a song form. So we figured, oh, this is the guy we need, because this one-stop shopping, you know, he can write, he can sing, he can play guitar, and he looks the part. So
excellent.
And it wasn't just looks. He lived the part, too.
Now there's the three of you guys are together, and this is pretty much what it became, the first incarnation of FUs, essentially, right? How did the band name come
together? Yeah, I switched from guitar to bass when Steve joined. Mm-hmm. I went to this pawn shop and bought this Hondo bass. So, well, I think I already had it, but I wasn't using it. But I had this Hondo bass that sounded good, but the action was really horrible. And I played that and I sang, and it was fun, but it wasn't that fun for me. Cause you know, I was inspired by mostly frontmen. You know, most of the lead singers that also play guitar are like, do that cause they're really good at guitar, and I couldn't make that claim. So I also wanted the freedom to like go around the stage and, you know, and mug at the audience and like Steve and Johnny and, you know, people like that. And so I was happy that we were deciding to get a bass player. And I think Steve knew Wayne and
and
Wayne was like, wow, this guy looks like a Didi Ramone's brother. So he fit right in too, you know. And then we had already made a demo as a three piece, but then once Wayne joined, we got this call. It was unexpected. John Anastas was from DYS, and when we met him, he was in Decadence. But he was working as a cashier in Newbury Comics, which is owned by Mike Dreese, who wanted to put out a Boston punk record, but he didn't know much about it. And he had asked SSD, he still had enough room for another band and a few more songs. And SSD turned him down. So he asked Jonathan, you know, you know any other bands that could fill in? He said, yeah, I know these guys, the FU. So he told us about it. And that was how we got on to that. And so that was our first recording, all four of us.
Let me go back a little bit from that point, John. See, even before the Boston Not LA, which is a landmark record for a lot of reasons, but you guys, like you said, you did a demo as a three-piece first, right? And then before Wayne joined the band, I think you played your first show even as a three-piece, right? And it was Meteor Workshop?
Right, yeah. That's Meteor Workshop, yes.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. That's another historic place. So back in these days, of course, there really weren't many venues doing these kind of shows, right? And,
right,
and
right.
To that point, I wanted to get back to Steve. Oh, actually, first of all, before I go back to Steve, the name FUs, how did that come about?
It was the only song I had written at that time, FU. And we were like, we need a name. And I just said, oh, why don't we call ourselves the FUs? And, you know. Steve and Bob started laughing out loud. I said, no, I guess that's the name.
Excellent. And at this point, like I said, there weren't really many places doing these kind of shows that became, you know, became punk hardcore shows, what you want to call it. But Steve, you were also very involved, and I didn't know this till today, very instrumental in bringing some of those big shows to Boston. Maybe talk about the show in 1982, the first one.
Wait, which one was the show in 1982?
Sorry, The Misfits at the Church.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was the most legendary one, probably. I don't know. We had... You asked previously how I had contacted Glenn, and I'm not... Or Glenn Danzig about playing there, and I... At some point, we had met them, and I think, down in front of Stevie's or something. And at some point, I had gotten his phone number, and I called him up and asked if they wanted to play there. And that became a huge show. I mean, us and DYS and I think Negative FX and Misfits, you know.
Legendary show lineup for sure.
Joe ran a great flyer for that show. It was based on the Curb Your Dog thing that was for Mailmen. Mm-hmm. It just had this snarling dog, and he just put the details of the show over the words of the original poster. But it looked great.
It's brilliant. But yeah, the Gallery East and Media Workshop were two of the, you know, only places really doing shows back then. They were very non-specific venues to this kind of stuff, but they allowed them. And then, like you say, some of the bigger shows, you were looking for your own places, whether it was a hall or a church or whatnot. And so Steve was actually really interested in that Misfit show. And then also a year later, in the March of 83, another famous VFW show in Waltham. Talk about that for a bit, if you don't mind, Steve.
Well, that was, Lethal from SSD was involved in that too, because it was us and SSD, and but we got Minor Threat and Necros and Meatmen. I think Meatmen were kind of a late addition on there. Did DYS play? DYS played, right?
Yeah. Did they? I'm not sure. They might not have been a thing yet.
Okay.
Played the Misfits show, but I'm not sure they played the Minor Threat show.
This kind of ties from the point where, like, how the band name was getting out there. So after you were playing some pretty big shows, I think that's where, John, you mentioned how John Anastas had suggested you guys, when they're from Mike Treese and Newberry's trying to fill out the lineup for the This Is Boston on LA. So, very fortuitous that he did that, because obviously you guys ended up on that disc, which, you know, very famous with, you know, Jerry's Kids and the Proletariat, Gangrene, of course, and Decadent.
Yeah.
Really, really, you know, spoken to as like one of the most influential records to come out from that whole scene. And it's still, you know, still to this day, it's referenced all the time. That had to, of course, help you guys out, getting your name out there even further, right? And so, now you're playing shows, you're in the area, whatnot, things are going pretty well. And then, like, your first show at the channel ends up being in March of 82. No, I'm sorry, hold on. Let me list here. Where did I put my list? Sorry.
3/20/83.
March 83, yeah, March 83. And it's Misfits, Jerry's Kids, The Freeze, and FU. Another, like, legendary show. And then, I guess, one of the, that was like one of the biggest shows of the channel at that point, I think.
Yeah.
All ages afternoon. All ages afternoon, yeah.
I remember.
Well, talk about memories of that show, guys. That's a pretty historic show as well. Give us some memories from that show.
Talk about which?
It's the first show, the channel. Your first channel gig in March 20 of 83, where you were with the Misfits and Jerry's Kids in the Freeze.
Oh, yeah, that was terrifying. you know, and I'm glad we were known for playing fast, because we were so nervous we played everything twice as fast as, and it was already fast.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, just going from, like, playing in people's basements to, like, this huge crowd in front of us and like, people jumping on stage, slam dancing, and which they used to call it back then. And people coming up to me and grabbing the microphone to sing into it and having my mic cord get pulled out. The same thing happened to Glenn. You can see in the videos, because there's videos from Red Shark of that show.
Yep.
You know, same thing happened. He got a bunch of kids to crowd him to sing along, and then he realized he didn't have a cord in his microphone anymore. So I guess Dinky was on hand to quickly give us a replacement, because we were able to finish the songs.
Well, that was fun on stage with you guys as Straw Dogs. I remember a bunch of shows that you did.
Well, this would have been the FUs. Were you involved back then?
84. Suicidal Tendencies. All Ages, okay. And you were as FUs. I remember that. Then there was a Minuteman All Ages in 85.
Yeah.
And then everything was 86 with Straw Dogs. And
right,
Pat on the Back. And then you did Extreme opening in 8/15 86 with Straw Dogs. Steel Pulse you opened for.
Blackpool, England, yeah.
Then Circle Jerks and what have you in the Neighbourhoods. You did that on the 10/19/86. Then Circle Jerks, mm-hmm. All Ages again, you guys are Straw Dogs. And then some real good ones, 11/22/87, Jerry's Kids, Straw Dogs, the Crew, Psycho, and all that kind of stuff, you know. And then and then later on they did the Nervous Eaters, and then he did Social Distortion again with Mallet Head and Straw Dogs in 89. But what gets me, you were then headlining for WNF and X Night on 207.90. And everybody behind you, Hunter, Mission, Transit, all different bands. But you guys were headlining. And that's...
We were pretty lucky back then. I mean, we were also talented. We also delivered. But, you know, we're lucky because we knew people.
No, it was, as Sean will say, this is the time when everybody on the radio stations were playing local stuff because they knew some of it was so good. And and each one of these stations had their own DJ that did local all the time, and it was great to hear that rather than just the same old, you know. And you would hear it was surprising me, especially like BCN, WFNX, and stations like that. And as Sean would say, they opened a lot of doors for a lot of people in this state. And what have you? So that it's a good thing.
Yeah.
But
I didn't want to skip all the way from FUs to Straw Dogs. We'll talk about how that transition happened. But that said, I mean, John, we were talking about a little earlier how, like you mentioned in BCN, Dinky, how they used to have a local top three on Ken Shelton's show. Maybe talk about that real quick, John. Then we'll go back to the beginnings of the Straw Dogs.
He had a popular show called Top Local 3, and, you know, people would call in and vote for their favorite local song by an original band. And Straw Dogs had put out that record with the Queen cover, Tie Your Mother Down. And, you know, I think we made it our own. We put a lot more energy and a lot more in your face about it. And, and that was the top local three for the summer of 86. And one time I was driving through Cambridge, and I came to a red light, and it was a hot summer day, and this red Corvette, looked like a brand new red Corvette, convertible with the top down, and there's a guy in there, you know, looking like Steve Perry from Journey, you know, long brown hair and a mustache.
I think Steve Perry was cranking his music up.
Yeah, Steve Perry clone, and he had these black leather seats, and he let the seat back, you know, it's kind of like a Van Halen song in real time, and he's just really rocking out to the song, and I thought, wow, I'm part of this guy's heavy metal weekend, and it was a pivotal moment in my life, let's say.
That's great. That's really great. I mean, always hearing your stuff on the radio for the first time is a pretty amazing thing, you know?
Yeah. On a commercial station, no less. You know?
No less. That's even better. Oh, wow.
Yeah. 50,000 watts. Perfect. So ironically enough, like I said, Ian didn't come into the band until 2015. However, he did attend as a fan, you know, three of those first four shows you guys played at the channel. So, Ian, this is kind of a unique from your end.
Yeah, sure.
Give us your perspective on seeing, you knew who the band was already, you're aware of them, but give us your perspective of seeing FUs in front of, you know, 1,000-something people at the channel on a big stage doing their thing and with the Misfits on the list.
Well, I wasn't at the Misfits show that they
played. I'm sorry, not the Misfits, the other three shows, my bad.
But FUs were, I was a big fan of the band. They were a band that I thought just was just leaped and jumped above some of the other bands in town, primarily because as the 83 went into 84, Boston hardcore was definitely taking a transition to a more of a heavy metal based sound. Whereas bands like SSD Control changed their name to SSD at that point and were now having a record of songs that I actually quite liked, the How We Rock record. Most of those songs live sounded like hardcore songs, and there was still a hardcore performance. But by the time the record comes out, it comes out with a record cover that's like an airbrushed cover of a road. You know, it looked an awful lot like the Judas Priest album cover, and the back of the cover looked like the AC/DC record cover for Those About to Rock. It's the same color gold, and the songs were slower, and Francois was doing leads over the whole thing. And so it really felt like a big step away from the hardcore punk stuff that I really liked. And here comes the FUs with Do We Really Want to Hurt You? And it is a solid punk record. Not as fast as My America, but every bit as aggressive and punk sounding as you would want from a punk band. And so they have some fast songs. They've got some very mid-tempo songs. But the whole thing is great slam dancing material. And one of my favorite memories of them at that period of time is the Suicidal Stranglehold show that they played in 84. They introduced a new guitar player to the band, Steve Martin, and now the band has a huge full sound. I brought a buddy of mine to that show from high school. It was his first punk show he'd ever been to. And the first thing he saw was Stranglehold, and he wasn't all that jived up on it. I really liked Stranglehold a lot, but that to him didn't seem all that exciting. But when he saw the FUs, he was knocked out. And I remember the FUs hitting the stage at the channel with that lineup and playing those songs, you know, Warlords, Young Fast Iranian, and they sounded huge with two guitars. And I remember that point thinking, okay, this band is really stepping into a new arena because they were taking punk back at, you know, music into the two guitar, slightly metal, but keeping the same fast pace and the same energy from hardcore. And I thought it was an exciting direction. I was very thrilled to hear where they were going to go. And the same thing can be said, you know, with the progress that by the time they were doing the Minutemen show in early 85, you know, now they're bringing some new songs in that will, you know, that, you know, In Deep, I think, might have been around that time. Their look is a little more heavy metal. The hair's getting longer. The clothes are getting a little more, more metal looking. I think John Stock might have had a funny belt at the time that looked kind of heavy metal and maybe some eyeliner. I don't know. One of my favorite things about that Minutemen show was I was all excited to go. I had a pretty good punk look at that time. I went to the Newton Center train stop to get the train to go to the channel. I would take it to Park Street and then switch over to the Red Line and to South Station or whatever, to go to the show. I remember when I got to the train station, there was a whole bunch of guys from my high school drinking beers and hanging out. And I was waiting for the train, and next thing a beer comes flying at me. Somebody got me in a headlock, and I had to fucking run. So I ran away from the train stop, and I realized, oh, shit, I can't go to the show, you know, because these fucking guys are at the train stop. They want to kick my ass. So the only thing I could think of was to run from Newton Corner to Chestnut Hill and catch the next train from there. And I'll never forget, because I was in a T-shirt, you know, and it's, I think it's pretty cold at that time of the year when that show was. And I had a T-shirt and I had a flannel shirt over it, you know, and I had to fucking run from Newton Center to Chestnut Hill, you know, which was a pretty damn long run, you know, around the pond that's over, you know, the reservoir over there or whatever. And so it was a beast to get that train and go to that show.
That's a dedication there.
Serious dedication. And that show was fantastic. I was also a big Minutemen fan. That was, the second time I saw the Minutemen. Also, the first time was at the channel with Hister Du a year before.
Ian, you didn't play in the band at that point, but you had been to the channel numerous times.
Numerous times. I mean, that was, you know, those shows were all ages, and they were $6. And I wouldn't think of missing one of those. If you're in high school, and you've got, you know, you're interested in girls, you're interested in punk girls, and you're interested in making friends and hanging out in Kenmore or Harvard, you know, everybody was at those things that I cared about, that I was interested in knowing. And I would go to every show and hang out and have a great time. And
about your background with your family and the Berkeley and jazz thing, you also attended the Charlie Watts show with your family, right?
I did. My stepdad, Tom Fleetek, was the chairman of the brass department at Berklee College of Music, and he was learning something called circular breathing with a trombone. And so he would breathe in through his nose and exhale through his mouth. And the master of doing that was a British jazz player named Paul Rutherford, a free jazz player, really pretty far out stuff. And he was in the Charlie Watts band. So when Charlie Watts Orchestra came to the channel, my parents were able to get me in. Now that's a 21 plus show, and I'm pretty sure I just finished high school, so I was probably like 17 or 18. My parents were able to get me in and go in. And the channel was amazing because for that show, I think that was like a 30-piece band, you know? And they had all those people up on the stage at the channel, you know, which was pretty packed, of course. Little stairs with all these people taking a stand to do a solo. It was wild. And I got to meet Paul Rutherford. And say hello to Charlie. I didn't get a chance to talk to him per se, but I was able to shake his hand or say hello.
That's a very cool memory for the channel,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
So I think I know we're coming to the hour, I think, now, thank you. So does it make sense to end for here for now, and then we can kind of pick it up next week and get back more into the Straw Dogs and whatnot?
Yeah. All right.
This sounds good. And before you guys go, I just wanted to let you know about this heavy metal trivia.
Trivia question.
You know my... Sure. My band is Fleetwood Mac, the original Peter Green Fleetwood Mac. Well, one of the songs that Peter did with me was a song called Green Manalishi. Now, Green Manalishi became a lot of the early guys who were doing heavy metal. They really latched onto that and used that as a lot of their bass.
And Priest.
It's in the history books. I couldn't believe it. I started reading this stuff, and I said, are you kidding me? I didn't know that. You see, the song is a very interesting song. Not only is it real power chords from Peter and Danny, it's about Danny. He got into trouble in Detroit, I think it was, with some woman, and unfortunately it's a Green Man Alicia with a two-pronged crown, bringing me up, bringing me down. And then when you start talking about that, people didn't realize until they understood it was about a good old gonorrhea dose. So it's like, oh, come on. So and that's one of the reasons.
Three-pronged crown must have hurt.
That's one of the reasons. No, but not just the lyrics, but the way he did the chords and stuff, the power chords and whatever, moving on, you know, his blues style. But it was just very heavy, heavy power chords that a lot of the early heavy metal writers latched onto it and used a lot of that feeling and a lot of that what was going on. I thought that was really interesting.
Great story.
I thought it was cool. Interesting for you guys to hear that, yeah. Because now you'll all go play Green Man Militia and freak out. But you have to play the original one from Peter. It's some of the live stuff I've got that Peter did on that just blew you away in 1969, 1970.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
Thomas says hi.
Yes, let's do this. Part two next week at 5 o'clock, and see if we can get joined on with Bob. You know, I mean, let's see if it all happens, but. Even if Bob don't come on, you guys have got a lot to say, and it's really cool stuff. And now, when you now you're just talking about the channel stuff and your times going in there, Sean's going to lap you up with that one. It's awesome. And I knew you were in there a lot of different, because most of your bands were, they followed other people that come in and check through the back door or something, you know, and check the band out. Say, oh, that's cool. We saw a bunch of stage divers. Let me leave for now. and it's good though. Well, I want to thank you for Two Pints in a Corner, and this will be Two Pints in a Corner closing out.